Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you, Nick. Welcome to Monday's programme. Did you have a nice weekend? I hope you did. Hope you're in good form. Dr. Vernon Coleman returns this afternoon, of course. He's with us every Monday around 5:30. We'll have Dr. Vernon Coleman on. And Stuart Waiton, PhD from Abertay University, will join us a bit later on to talk about identity politics, trigger warnings, free speech, cancel culture, and much more besides. You don't want to miss Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Isn't it very interesting there on the news coming from the United States, polling showing that many families reluctant to give the flu vaccine to their children or to themselves. We might get into that with Vernon Coleman today. You can tweet the programme at Richie Allen Show. You know how it works now, so do it now and let's get on with it. I tell you, a lot of, I suppose the show gets a lot of correspondence, but in recent weeks and months it's trebled, it's quadrupled. A lot of interesting emails coming into the programme. And I want to read this email from a good friend of mine. He's a long-time listener, so he is, Joseph. I'm just going to say Joseph for now. Richie, I hope you're well, he emails. I was at the Trafalgar Square protest on Saturday and was a first-hand witness to its peaceful conduct, as well as the organisers regularly announcing that the event was to be peaceful, all violence was to be avoided, and even complimenting the police liaison officer who helped organise the event, in addition to holding a minute's silence for the police officer who was murdered in Croydon, together with victims of lockdown. As such, the sight of the police appearing in force moments after David Icke had finished speaking and when the crowd was beginning to disperse was a complete surprise and completely unnecessary. I was kettled within the upper platform beside the organiser's tent, so had a close view of the police aggression, which was not reciprocated by the crowd, who remained peaceful and were shouting to others to also remain calm and peaceful and not to engage in any violence. Frankly, I felt quite despondent after this experience, and I have been trying to think of how we could turn things around, which I'm still struggling with. And then Joseph sent me a link to the Repeal the Coronavirus Act 2020 petition, which you can find if you go to petition.parliament.uk. It's petition number 313310. 313310. Repeal the Coronavirus Act. I signed it this morning, says Joseph, and was surprised to see we're still some way below the required 100,000 signatures, albeit I presume they are fudging the numbers. That said, prior to my sister sending this to me, I wasn't aware of such a petition anyway, so maybe others are unaware. So he's asked me to give it a mention. And he also mentioned, did Joseph, there was a lady at the demo holding a Listen to the Richie Allen Show placard, and in retrospect, I'm gutted I didn't take a photo of this. One or two people did send photographs, and I think the lady's name is Keely, and she is a listener to the programme. So to Keely, thank you so much for taking the opportunity to write the name of the show down and to display it in the square there. All publicity is greatly appreciated and received, Keely. Thank you so much. Thank you, Joseph. Now, Mark emailed me. This is equally as interesting. Listeners are on the case. I like it. Mark emailed Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, and he got a reply. Shall I read you Mark's email to the Foreign Secretary, the Right Honourable? Yeah, Dominic Raab. Is it true, writes Mark? Dear Dominic Raab, is it true that 93% of COVID-19 tests are false positives? Are, as per your statement on your recent interview with Kay Burley on Sky News? And is it also true that bars in Parliament were still open after 10 p.m. when public bars have to shut at 10 p.m. Now, the reply is very interesting. Ian Riley, senior caseworker to the Right Honourable Dominic Raab, wrote back, Dear Mark, from what I understand, what you have heard is correct. With best wishes, Ian Riley, senior caseworker to the Right Honourable Dominic Raab. How interesting. Is it true, wrote Mark, 93% of COVID-19 tests are false positives? As you said in your interview with the Ginger Ninja. The reply was, dear Mark, from what I understand, what you have heard is correct. Best wishes, Ian Riley. I have the email. Thank you, Mark. Forwarded from Ian Riley. Now, in March, Parliament passed the Coronavirus Act, as you know. It gave the government unprecedented powers to respond to the pandemic, giving the government powers to do whatever it bloody well liked. Local elections postponed, pubs closed down, factories, offices, people locked into their homes, killing grannies in care homes. The government could do what it liked. No need for debate or parliamentary vote. It basically put the country in the hands of Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty, the former being the government's chief scientific advisor, the latter being the government's chief medical officer. Time specific. The time, there was a time limit imposed on the Coronavirus Act. That time is up on Wednesday. The government wants it to be renewed so that it can carry on doing whatever it likes. They are debating it in Parliament today ahead of a vote on Wednesday. Sir Graham Brady, the top man, 1922 committee, backbench Conservatives, he's cheesed off. He wants Parliament to have a say over new national restrictions forevermore. They're debating it today. Matt Hancock is the Health Secretary, and he made a statement. As he was beginning his statement, he was asked to give way by a Conservative Party backbencher, and he gave way.
If the first duty of government is to keep people safe, would he remember the first duty of Parliament is to hold government to account? And therefore, I know he wants to take public opinion with him, but will he also reassure us that he's determined to take Parliament with him? And may I urge him in that respect to meet with my honourable friend, the member for Altrincham and Sale, and come to a compromise and ensure that if there are further national lockdowns, Parliament is fully involved in this process.
Mr. Speaker, I thought this might come up. I was going to develop the argument...
He's a funny guy, isn't he?
...develop the argument further before coming to the nub of this particular point. But since my right honourable friend has given me the opportunity, I strongly agree with the need for us in this House to have the appropriate level of scrutiny. We've already, as the Prime Minister set out last week, put in place further measures. The aim is to provide the House with the opportunity to scrutinise in advance through regular statements and debates, questioning the government's scientific advisers more regularly, which has already started, gaining access to local data, and having the daily calls with ministers, including my right honourable friend, the Paymaster General. We're looking at further ways to ensure the House can be properly involved in the process in advance where possible. And I hope to provide the House with further details soon, and I will take up the invitation to a further meeting with my right honourable friend, the member for Altrincham and Sale, with whom I've already met to discuss this matter, to see what further progress can be made. And I hope that that, for the time being, satisfies my right honourable friend.
By the way, the right honourable member for Altrincham and Sale is Sir Graham Brady. He's up these way, these parts even. Right, incidentally, after a massive outcry by the public today about the fact that these idiots could go on drinking till whenever they felt like it in Parliament in Westminster, the government climbed down rather meekly and said, OK then, we'll close our bars at 10 p.m. as well. All right. Ian Collins, radio show on Talk Radio this afternoon. Now, Talk Radio is a national speech-driven station, and Ian Collins' programme today was interesting for a number of reasons. Peter Ebdon was on, former world champion snooker player, professional healer, former guest here, and will be on again in the future. We like Peter a lot. It was a very good conversation. Peter raised some very interesting points, and Ian Collins was a very gracious host. After pointing out that the government downgraded COVID from a highly consequential disease back in March, a hugely important point by Peter, which never gets a mention in the media at all, Peter Ebdon spoke to Ian Collins about testing. Very good.
I think that the government have obviously been lying about the statistics from day one. And, you know, I've just given you the example there of COVID-19 being downgraded on the 19th of March. So my question would be, why did we possibly go into lockdown the following week when they knew the catastrophic events that that would
who downgraded it?
The government scientists. You still find that today on the UK Gov website. It's still there.
Yep.
I mean, the big problem is with the PCR testing, as you know. And as Dominic Raab quite rightly pointed out in an interview with Kay Burley on Sky just 2 or 3 days ago, the success rate of the PCR test is something in the region of 7%. So a 93% false positive rate is actually quite ridiculous. And to think that everybody's lives have been compromised by a faulty test is absolutely ridiculous. One of my personal favourites regarding the PCR test was a video from Dr. John Magufuli, the president of Tanzania. Most people watching mainstream media probably are not even aware of this, but he tested various animals. So this is the president of Tanzania. He tested various animals, including fruit, for the coronavirus, including a goat, a sheep, a papaya, without the testers knowing that they weren't actually testing human subjects. He tested a durian, and the results were inconclusive. He tested car oil, and the results were negative. He tested a papaya fruit, and the results came back positive for COVID-19. He tested a quare, which is a type of bird, which also tested positive for COVID-19. He tested a rabbit, which was interdeterminal, a goat, which was positive, and a sheep, which was negative. You know, that gives you an idea of what yeah. we're dealing with. The PCR tests are not fit for purpose. We should not be using the PCR tests. The whole lockdown was about the testing. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but approximately 2 or 3 days ago, Belgium, as a country, stopped using the PCR test, and quite rightly so, because they are not fit for purpose, and the UK government should be banning the PCR test now, as of today.
Brilliant stuff from Peter Ebdon. Give that man a banana. Although the banana would probably test positive for COVID-19. And if you give Peter Ebdon a banana, he'd probably make a 50 break with it. 55 or 57. Oh, he's missed the blue. Yeah, but don't be too hard on Peter. He's playing with a banana, Ted. Great stuff from Peter Ebdon. Dominic Raab, yes, the testing, the false positives. President John Magufuli from Tanzania, testing goats and fruit. It's a shambles. It should bring down the government. It should see people imprisoned. Excellent stuff. Ian Collins had this to say to Peter.
What about all the people that have died that wouldn't have died if COVID wasn't here, Peter?
It's absolutely terrible. Every
day. There's thousands and thousands across the world. This is four times more virulent than influenza.
No, I don't believe that. I don't think that's true at all. And you only have to look at Dr. Vernon Coleman. Dr. Vernon Coleman will be speaking later today, 5:30, on the Richie Allen Show. He's absolutely brilliant, Dr. Vernon Coleman. He has challenged anybody in the government or the medical industry to a live TV debate, and nobody will take him up, Dr. Vernon Coleman, because he would absolutely wipe the floor with them.
Is he not? By a weird coincidence, this is absolutely true, Peter. I was sitting at home this morning putting this show together, and I looked at my bookshelf and I pulled out a book written by Dr. Vernon Coleman, which was actually about the EU. He doesn't much care for the EU and the whole kind of unified system of governments that the EU have, of course. And
I don't blame him. I think the EU is a stepping stone to a one world government.
Well, I was going to come on to that.
Avoided at all costs.
A lot of what was in there, you know, I thought that I used to interview Vernon a bit. It was a bit of a conspiracy theorist, it seemed to me, Peter.
Oh.
Well, it's quite interesting that you've mentioned that, because I follow a guy called Phil Greaves on Twitter.
Wait till you hear this. This is mega stuff by Peter Ebdon. This is great stuff.
On Twitter. And he says conspiracy theory is a ruling class pejorative term for class consciousness. He also says anyone and everyone who deploys the conspiracy theory slur is a reactionary enemy of revolutionary science and truth, and or a juvenile screen-damaged imbecile, absolutely no exceptions.
I think, was it the CIA or something that first came up with the term conspiracy theories for the very reason that you've just, whatever people think about the reason you've given, but they came up with it in order to malign anyone that had a differing view from the government.
Good stuff, Ian Collins. Great stuff, Peter Ebdon. Peter Ebdon. Peter Ebdon, everybody. Yeah. Outstanding. Outstanding stuff. The CIA introduced the term conspiracy theory to basically diminish those in the eyes of the public, those who are asking questions about the assassination of JFK. Great stuff. This, eh? Our exciting day on radio today, listening to radio, was very good. Ian Collins, good job doing your job. Very, very, said it, tweeted it earlier on, excellent example of how to be a host. You can disagree, you can argue, you can use conspiracy theorist as a term if you want. Just give the other person a chance to speak. Well done, Ian Collins. Later on, because Peter stirred up a big old hornet's nest, Ian Collins was saying that he sympathises with the protesters and he agrees with them on some of the issues around freedom. But, says Ian Collins, at these protests, the loudest voices seem to be the nutters. So Simon rang up, a listener called Simon.
Well, I went on the march a few weeks ago and, yes, you're right, there is the contingent of nutcases who, you know, follow David Icke and what have you. But there's a big, I would say, sort of 75%, who don't, and they're actually just out there to, you know, complain against the government. And as I say to a researcher, if you've got a grievance against government, which a lot of us have, how else are you going to protest if you don't go along to these meetings?
The legions of people who read David Icke are not nutcases, far from it. I read David Icke, I'm not a nutcase. They read him because since the 1990s, he's written about the paradigm that we are seeing unfold in front of our eyes. Right. And it's ironic that the guy says nutcases who read David Icke. As far as I remember, when Eamon Holmes was working for Talk Radio, he did two very in-depth and very professional interviews with David Icke on that same channel, which I think are available on YouTube. But anyway, what are people meant to do if they can't assemble? He said, that's a good point. Here's a bit more. Dr. Vernon Coleman gets another mention.
When I interviewed Piers Corbyn, you know, who was on the other two marches, I don't know if he was there on Saturday, but I interviewed him and he came up with this name, Dr. Vernon Coleman. And Peter Ebdon, who we just had on, also cited Dr. Vernon Coleman. Now, I'm a bit disturbed, Simon, that the only medical name that keeps getting plucked out to corroborate this is Dr. Vernon Coleman.
Now, this isn't true. He must know this. Ian Collins. He must know that. He must have heard of Carl Hennigan, Sunetra Gupta. Surely. Come on, man.
And
no,
I'm not seeing many other conventional doctors signing up to this.
Dolores Cahill, the Irish lady, I watched one of the videos. She took 10 minutes to give you her qualifications. You know, there is plenty of well-qualified people out there, doctors and all the biochemists and all the people you'd like. If you scout around, you will find lots and lots of people who are well qualified to speak like this.
Good man. All you have to do is have a look around. Cahill is one, there are many of them. Just have a look around and you'll see them. More from that in a minute. I've got another cut from that conversation, but I want to save it till Vernon Coleman joins me in a few minutes' time. Here's a very interesting little snippet from BBC Radio 5 Live this morning. You may have heard of a lady called Sally Green Gross. Now, Sally is an elderly lady, one time acting Director General Age Concern. Not acting, she was the Director General of Age Concern, which, as you know, I'm sure you know, is a charity that caters for elderly people and it looks out for the rights of the elderly. And, well, it should, right? Now, Sally was once the Director General, and she was on Radio 5 Live today speaking with Rachel Burden, and she was talking about keeping people apart at Christmas, isolating the elderly and what that would do to them. This is kind of emotional and poignant. Listen to Sally Greengross.
Well, I think we've got to be very careful about people's mental health. And Looking forward to Christmas and a Christmas with close family. And often people don't see their family during the year because they're a long way away. This is something that is so important to people that they may give up altogether and just say, well, it's not worth going on. And I'm frightened of that for so many people. It's this winter. In the middle of winter, Christmas sort of cheers people up, gives them something to look forward to. I'm just hoping that if people really obey all the rules now, that just near Christmas, maybe the government will have a change of heart and say, well, Christmas is special. You can be with your family and or your close friends, your close people, just for that holiday, because I think it's very important that we watch very carefully people's mental health. They're sometimes at the end of the line, and we don't want them feeling, well, life isn't worth living anymore. Yeah. And it's a danger that if you isolate people too much, that's what they're going to feel.
Do you think older people should have a right to say, my choice, if I decide I want to put potentially my health at risk by mixing with other people, that is up to me?
Well, I do, really. I have to say that's my own feeling, that in the long run, people make a choice.
Would you yourself ignore restrictions to spend Christmas with your family?
Yes, I would, I think, just for Christmas Day. But, you know, it's every individual's choice.
Yeah, it should be every individual's choice. That was Sally Greengrowth there, the one-time Director General of the organisation Age Concern. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show. A lot of new listeners joining this programme, and I'm sure other independent programmes are seeing an increase in new listeners over the last few weeks and months. So look, welcome to the show. Good to be with you. I was asked a question the other day about phone-ins. I think we'll do a phone-in on Thursday. How about that? Got a packed old show coming up this week. One of the authors, I was sent a book last week by Chelsea Green Publishing, and thanks to Katie and Harshita at Chelsea Green Publishing, they sent me the book Corona False Alarm, written by Dr. Karina Royce and by Dr. Sukarat Bagdi. These are proper doctors and academics. They've written this book, and I've got it in my hand. They sent it to me last week. And one of the doctors will be with me on the show tomorrow. Richard and Fred from Right Said Fred will be on the programme tomorrow as well. I'm delighted about that, not least because I got to know Fred 3 or 4 years ago and he came on the programme. I've kept in touch with him and his family since. So they'll be on the programme tomorrow. They've been getting a lot of stick in the press today because they went to Trafalgar Square on Saturday, which is their inalienable right as human beings to go outdoors and to meet people. And they're getting hammered for it. Not that they care. They've got very thick skin. The Freds, at the Freds on Twitter. Gerald Salente will be with me on Wednesday. And there is somebody else on Wednesday as well. So how about we clear the decks on Thursday and we have a phone in from start to finish. So I'm giving you a heads up. On Thursday, I'm going to open the telephone and the Skype line. So keep that in mind. And we'll have a chat, me and you, and we'll put the world to rights. God damn it. Alrighty. Somebody tweeted me to say that Peter Ebdon would beat me with a banana at snooker if I was using a cue. I'm sure he would. You'll get no argument from me. This is the BBG, not the BBC. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. Dr. Vernon Coleman, an old man in a chair, will be with me in about 2.5 minutes time. Don't go anywhere. Yeah, for some reason, it isn't very warm outside, but the studio is stiflingly warm. I think we better move to aircon for somebody informed the Joint Chiefs, as it were. Yes. Listen, lots of tweets. Thank you for them. A lot of tweets. Engage with each other on Twitter. Put Richie Allen Show into search Twitter. Press enter. Let's welcome back the very distinguished guest. Joins us every Monday at 5:30. Former GP, of course. Hugely successful author, national newspaper columnist, and these days on brandnewtube.com, you can watch him where he presents the brilliant and the very important An Old Man in a Chair. And we'll talk about it, particularly yesterday's episode. Let's welcome back to the show the one and only Dr. Vernon Coleman. Vernon, welcome back.
Thank you, Richie.
Now, let me get rid of that music there. Before we go anywhere, Ian Collins on Talk Radio this afternoon, having finished speaking to former world champion snooker player Peter Ebdon, was phoned by various members of the public, including a guy called Simon. And Simon was lamenting the fact that there isn't any debate, really, between academics on the media today. This is what Ian Collins had to say. Have a listen.
If you look around the internet, there's plenty of people who are against what's happening now. And then you think, well, why aren't we having a debate on the media that where we get, you know, Coleman up there, we get one of the experts from the government and sit there and watch both sides of the argument, and then we can make our own mind up. The fact that they're keeping all these people under lock and key, yep. You know, as soon as the video goes,
I tell you what, you've thrown me an open goal here, Simon. I've got to take it. Let's do it, Ricky. Vernon Coleman versus one of the virologists that we speak to. Simon, leave it with us. I don't know whether Mr. Coleman will speak. There was a time on Talk when I was on TalkSport a bunch of years ago. We had him as a kind of regular feature.
Yeah, he doesn't know whether Mr. Coleman will speak. I'm guessing Mr. Coleman will be only too glad to speak.
I'm guessing Mr. Collins's bosses will tell him he's not allowed to have me on his programme. That's what I'm guessing. I'm also rather surprised that Ian Collins didn't know about the government downgrade on March the 19th. Yeah, there's a link on my website which takes you straight there, because the government rather hid it. On March the 19th, and I mentioned that in one of my very first videos way back then, the government downgraded the coronavirus, the COVID-19 killer virus, big joke, they downgraded it to ordinary flu. And then 3 days later, they published a 300-and-something page document that they just happened to have lying around, the emergency bill, and then they put the country into lockdown. They had just been told that this was no more dangerous than the flu. And the media, the mass media, did nothing. They left the story alone. They did nothing with it. And I'm amazed, Ian, that you weren't aware of that. Go to my website, have a look, go to the health section, and you'll find there's a little button to press that'll take you straight to the bit on the government website where they actually downgraded it. It was an official government advisory pathogen committee.
As somebody who used to produce presenters in commercial radio, as I did, I'll give Collins the benefit of the doubt, Vernon, because my presenters, brilliant broadcasters and lovely men and women as they were a bit lazy. And they depended on me telling them things. They weren't going looking for a lot of this stuff themselves, mostly reading the broadsheet. So I guess he probably doesn't know. But it was brilliant to hear Peter Ebdon educate him on that point, because that is a huge point. And of course, yes, you have been banging the drum on that since day one. Yesterday's episode of An Old Man in a Chair on brandnewtube.com was outstanding. It's very, very succinct. There's no fat in these episodes. It's to the point. It's brilliant. It's wry, dry humour, but loaded with facts. You posed a very interesting question, and it got me thinking for most of the rest of last evening. If people are compelled to pay their TV licence, which currently they are, although apparently it's going to be a change in the offing where you might not go to prison if you don't pay for it. You'll still be fined. But if we're compelled to pay for it, and if the BBC declares itself to be the educator, entertainer and informer of us all, you asked the fantastically interesting question, and I would hope legal scholars around the country would be thinking about it. If somebody was to be injured by a vaccine, wouldn't the BBC have some liability, as you brilliantly pointed out in your programme yesterday, when it is admitting on the airwaves that even if somebody is right, whether they're wrong or right, we're not going to entertain any debate on vaccines. Surely the BBC has some liability. That's an excellent point, that, and I think it's one worth exploring.
Absolutely. The BBC has a charter. It has a very special privileged place in our society, and it's betrayed us totally. I mean, it's been betraying us for years, but during this hoax, it's betrayed everybody terribly, because it's actually suppressed an awful lot of information that's terribly important, and it's given people who are putting forward the lies and the nonsenses a very free platform. So you get Hancock allowed to talk all sorts of rubbish about testing, which he doesn't seem to understand from what I've heard of him, and to give all sorts of nonsensical half-truths on the BBC because they're only giving half of the side. Well, the BBC only talks to pro-vaxxers. That's their policy.
Yeah.
So they will not talk to someone like me. I rather deplore the phrase anti-vaxxer because it suggests some sort of Luddite lunacy. I am simply keen in finding the truth about medicines, and I've been doing it for a long, long time. And I try to find out the evidence which is available to show you whether, for example, a vaccine does more harm than good. What I did yesterday was actually take apart the flu vaccine that they're trying to push so hard at the moment. And I rather suspect that Matt Hancock has absolutely no idea of what the flu vaccine can really do to you. I think Mr. Hancock probably knows a good deal more than he's letting on about the various machinations and almost criminal. Well, no, they are criminal goings on behind the scenes. But as far as vaccines concerned, I really am amazed at the way the BBC allows these people to get away with talking such absolute rubbish. They haven't even said anything about the fact that Valance, who's the chief scientific advisor, of course, is an ex-GSK, GlaxoSmithKline employee, who was there for years and years when Glaxo was paying out huge billions of dollars in fines and damages and what have you. Valance actually still has shares in GSK. Now, we've got this bizarre... If this was a local planning committee, a local planning office, and one of the guys working in the planning office had shares in a local builder, I think the local newspaper would be raising an eyebrow and saying, or raising a collective eyebrow, and sort of saying, is this really what we want in our planning department? Matt Hancock, when faced with the fact that Valance, who's supposed to be in charge of the government's scientific decisions, is actually commercially linked in having shares to one of the big competitors for making a drug that's going to make, or a vaccine that's going to make billions, he didn't seem to think it mattered.
Yeah.
What sort of government have we got, for heaven's sakes? And what about all the science about the vaccines? Why doesn't the BBC have, you don't have to be me, but there are other doctors around. It's nonsense to say that there aren't. There are all sorts of problems. The COVID-19 vaccine, it's alleged now so far, I say alleged because I haven't got any documentary proof of it, but it seems fairly clear because they did actually stop the trial. This is AstraZeneca we're talking about, for two patients that got transverse myelitis. Well, that's a rare disease. And AstraZeneca seemed to me, in a document I saw from them, they seemed to think, well, this is just a coincidence. Well, it's a very rare condition. And it's also a condition that's known to be a consequence of having a vaccine. So this also, the BBC needs to have someone like me to take on the pro-vaxxers and to put them right. They say, the pro-vaxxers say that nobody ever gets really hurt by the, you might get a little bit of a sore arm or something. But the American government has paid out, I can't remember how many off the top of my head, but billions, that's with a B, of dollars to people who've been killed or seriously injured by vaccines. Now, they don't give out billions of dollars to people who have just got a bit of a sore arm and a red spot. The British government paid out $60 million to people who'd been injured by one vaccine in this country. Vaccine damage is a serious, serious problem, and we're not talking, as they like to talk, about little things like a bit of nausea or a headache or whatever. We're talking about serious problems, encephalomyelitis. We're talking about Guillain-Barré syndrome. We're talking about kidney problems, thrombocytopenia. We're talking about serious illnesses which can destroy people's lives. And the tape, the clip that you put on your program, which is what triggered my discourse yesterday on the BBC and how it's deliberately suppressed the truth was of a woman I'd never heard of on a radio programme I'd never listened to, but she actually admitted that the BBC does not, I mean, we all knew this, but she actually admitted live on air that the BBC does not debate with people who oppose, criticise, whatever, vaccination. So you've got a one-track BBC. All the BBC is doing is telling people why they should have a vaccine and all the good things. Now, I think that that makes the BBC legally responsible for the people who are going to be injured by vaccination, because the BBC is the broadcaster of record. And there they are saying, don't worry about vaccines. Everything's fine. There's no need to worry. Occasionally you hear these nutters or nuts, as Boris Johnson said, who are critical of vaccination. We're not saying that all vaccines are bad inherently. We're saying, look at vaccines in a scientific way and then make a choice. And I think that one of the things that people should be doing is ringing up their local BBC, national BBC, all the radio programs that have phone-ins. Tell them, when you get through to somebody in the studio, tell them, look, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, because if they think you're an anti-vaxxer, they'll just not have you on air. But then ask some serious questions. There's piles of information on my website. I can't remember all the stuff, but ask them, what about these side effects? What about the people who've been injured by vaccines? What about the drug companies? GlaxoSmithKline was fined some massive amount of money by the Chinese for bribery, for heaven's sakes. This was when Valence was at the company.
When he was there.
I don't know whether he was on the board at the time, but he was later on the board, and he was certainly a senior executive. I want to know who in the government is making a fair and rational decision about vaccination, because they are encouraging people to believe, the government and the BBC, which is the propaganda unit for the government, they are making it clear to people that we will only be free of something that they have wildly exaggerated when we've got a vaccine. And when I say wildly exaggerated, I'm not talking hyperbole. If you look at the
Vernon
Fauci,
you're back.
The Dr. Fauci, the Trump's right-hand coronavirus guy, he actually said in a journal article that the risks, this was months ago, that the risks were similar to the risks of flu. So people who say, well, the risks are much greater with flu, where's your evidence? All the people who've looked at this say the risks are similar to flu. And I'll tell you some other, they use so many little tricks. One trick is that they're now saying, oh, well, the number of deaths with COVID-19 is approaching a million. Well, we all know that that's fake because the Americans have admitted that they overdid their statistics by 94%, because huge numbers of people who were put down as dying of COVID actually had other very serious comorbidities. And the British government admitted that, backpedaled and knocked 5,000, I think it was, off their mortality list. But the big trick the World Health Organization is playing at the moment is that they're saying it's nearly a million. Well, I'm sorry, but you can't do that with statistics, because the flu season ends in May, October to May. So the number of flu deaths, which in a reasonably bad year can be 650,000 deaths, which is the point I made 6 months ago, 650,000 people a year can die of the flu. Well, if you look carefully at the number of people alleged to have died of COVID-19, it's a hell of a lot less than that. And we are now in September, not May. May, the flu death totals stop in May, but with the COVID-19 deaths, they're just going to go on. And I'll tell you this, Richie, if they just go on to the year 2030, they'll probably be able to get it to a genuine million. By then, the number of people who will have died of the ordinary flu will be probably 6.5 million. So everywhere you look, there are lies and deceits.
Not to mention as well, Vernon, sorry to interrupt, not to mention as well something which we can't not bring into this, is you discussing on recent episodes of an old man in a chair, and predicting it actually. They admitted But they stated on the other side of the world that flu seems to have just disappeared off the face of the earth, you know, leading any logical human being to at least consider that they are diagnosing flu cases as COVID. That's very important to acknowledge, yeah.
The figures for Australia, if you add the figures for flu in Australia this year, which are very low, to the figures from that are allegedly died from COVID, by one of those little amazing coincidences, they almost match exactly the death figures for flu in Australia last year. So all that's happened is that people are being, if you have a cough and you die, whether you've got something else or not, then you died of COVID. You didn't die of... The number of deaths from pneumonia and flu has fallen in this country, though I have to say it's still between 6 and 10 times as high as the number of deaths from COVID. The number of deaths from COVID at the moment is so small, and I'm not putting down and being trivial about people who die. It's awful, but I am cross about the number of people who are dying because of the lockdowns. If you look at the death rate, the number of people falling down is now greater, who die of falling down, elderly people, is now greater than the number of people dying of COVID-19.
How can you be so sure of that? You mentioned this last week and I should have jumped all over it. Why do you say that?
Because I looked at the government's statistical figures for mortality rates.
Wow.
And you can, from there. So that wasn't just off the top of my head. I don't do stuff.
No, I'm not saying you do. I'm not saying you do. But some of our listeners new to this programme, they say Paddy has given the doctor an easy ride here.
No.
Yeah.
You go and look at the government's mortality figures, and then you look at the mortality figures for COVID-19, and you look up all the other different sorts of things that people die of. And actually, you'll see that one of the other interesting things is that the infant mortality fell during the lockdowns. Now, what happened during... I've mentioned this before as well, but I think it's absolutely a crucial thing. What happened during that period that could have reduced infant mortality? Well, the logical explanation is that kids weren't having their vaccines.
You say the logical... Of course, and if there was another doctor here, again, not just to be a pain in the backside and play the devil's advocate, but another doctor might say... All right, that would be worth looking at, but we couldn't definitively state that now without further research. But I understand why you're saying that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, could that be?
Could it be, yeah.
The fact of the matter is that the mass media, the mass market media, of which we have to include the BBC, has hidden so much stuff, and they haven't asked questions. I mean, months ago, one big question was, does a flu vaccine increase your risks of getting COVID-19. Nobody investigated that. They should have done. There are a whole host of things. And the BBC has been so, going back to the BBC, has been so utterly corrupt. They haven't run stories, which they should have been. I didn't see any story on the BBC website about the German doctor, Dr. Schoening, who was arrested, handcuffed and held for, I think, 22 hours, for speaking the truth at a rally in London.
Well, trying to.
He didn't do anything. He wasn't beating anybody up. He wasn't attacking a police. He was talking at Hyde Park Corner, where you are traditionally allowed to talk about things. Now, I don't know who did that, whether it was Genghis Khan. Sorry, what's his name? I was thinking of history stuff.
Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London,
Or the dick woman, I don't know. But somebody made the decision that they were going to arrest a German, an eminent German doctor who dared to speak the truth. You and I both know of a doctor who was struck off in this country.
Yep.
Doctors in America have been threatened. Doctors in this country have been threatened. That's why there's not many doctors around. I happen to have earned my living writing books for a long time, and although I did work as a GP, and so I don't really care what the General Medical Council does. But a lot of doctors care. I think they care too much. They should be braver. But going back to the BBC, they didn't run the story, I didn't see it, about Dr. Schoening.
No.
They didn't run the story about doctors in Oklahoma who were taking legal action because of the danger of wearing masks to healthy people. They didn't run the story about a children's hospital, which is closing cancer wards until next May, allegedly because of problems with coronavirus. They didn't run a story about the testing properly. They didn't run the story about care homes that were paid a bonus of £1,500 to take in coronavirus patients. So these were patients who probably had the flu, or if they did have whatever they had flu-like symptoms, and they were dumped from hospitals, and the hospitals deliberately paid, or local councils deliberately paid extra money for care homes to take these. The BBC did, however, run a headline which said, low tax on heating, bad for climate, which was from some lobby pressure group I've never heard of. But that was the headline, low tax on heating, bad for climate, because the BBC cares desperately about the climate change rubbish, which it also doesn't tell the truth about. What the BBC didn't tell people is that up to 60,000 old people die every winter because of the cold.
Yeah.
And that's more than the number of people who are still alleged to have died between January and now of COVID-19. The whole thing is just getting...
If the government gave a damn about the welfare of senior citizens, it would ensure that fuel poverty was something that would be absolutely unthinkable in this country. You wouldn't have senior citizens not turning on the heating because they're terrified of not being able to pay the bills. I just want to just mention a couple of things. Dr. Vernon Coleman, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show today, Monday, September 28th, brandnewtube.com. Very quickly, this will take 20 seconds. Also, last week, when Patrick Vallance was outed by The Telegraph and The Daily Mail as having the £600,000 worth of shares in GSK, I scoured the BBC radio programmes, all of them, The Today programme, Breakfast Radio 5, the television, Victoria Derbyshire, 10 o'clock in the morning. None of them mentioned this, and that's unsurprising, I suppose, because the BBC has basically taken a pro-lockdown stance, and it hasn't really given airtime, apart from one or two interviews with Carl Hennigan. It hasn't really given the other side a chance. On what Vernon was saying earlier on, this is Emma Barnett last Wednesday on BBC Radio 5 Live. It's important we hear this now. If it plays for me, will you play for me, please? No, it's not going to play for me, is it? Come on, then. No?
We actually don't, as a matter of editorial policy, we don't debate with anti-vaxxers whether they're right or wrong. We actually don't do that.
We don't debate with them whether they are right or wrong. We don't do that, just in case people didn't hear that particular clip. Listen, there's Vernon, a lot of people got in touch with me to ask me to put questions to you. Too many to do in the time we have today. But a lady called Pippa Fuller sent a message through the Facebook page, which is managed by a friend of mine. Richie, with the latest set of bum fluffery from the government, most pubs and restaurants are making masks mandatory, and they're closing, of course, at 10 o'clock. I am exempt, says Pippa, and by law, I should not have to produce a doctor's certificate, which is what they are asking. I understand that pubs do not want even one unmasked person in the establishment causing any unrest. But where does that leave people like myself? I've been locked up for 5 months already. I have a disability. I'm waiting for a major operation in London for cancer. I've got asthma. I'd just like to take my hard-working son for one pint once a week, a little normality. Our time is precious. The government can't even get the guidelines right. Assume we have to lock ourselves up again due to a lack of their communication and lack of knowledge of the pubs, etc. The Disabilities Act. Maybe Vernon could throw some light on this. A lot of people got in touch with me today, honestly, to say we're terrified, even though we have an exemption for mask wearing. We're terrified because we're being asked and harassed. And even when we explain, we're being told to produce proof. Some woman said to me a couple of days ago, somebody demanded to see an inhaler, a salbutamol inhaler or something. Have you any advice on this, Vernon?
I have. You can get a lanyard from all sorts of places, including banks and supermarkets, I think. And the government has an exemption form that you can download, because they've told doctors doctors they mustn't give them. Although one woman whose doctor refused to give her an exemption certificate reported him to the General Medical Council. As far as I know, that's still going through. If 20,000 people did that, there'd be 20,000 very worried doctors, and that would block up the General Medical Council, which would be a terribly good thing. You can get certificates. Again, I think there's a link on my website to where you get the exemption certificate. If there isn't, we'll put one on. Where you can get an exemption certificate, you print it out and you stick it on your little lanyard. The government's advice is that no one is allowed unreasonably to ask you why you are exempt, and you are allowed to not wear a mask. And if people are being difficult, I would suggest that you tell them that you will report them. God knows who you report them to, actually. But you report them to the government, to the police. Oh, that's it. Report them to the police, because the government guidelines say that you cannot be forced to give information about why you need to have...
You're 100% right. You are 100% right. The Equalities Act protects people from being interrogated by security guards. You're spot on. I looked this up in advance. I knew you'd know. Yeah, you are protected. I have asthma. I it doesn't bother me very much. I do have an inhaler on hand just in case. And I do have it on my person most of the time. I don't wear a mask. I've been asked once or twice, are you wearing a mask? And I just say no. And I just kind of keep walking. I'm not rude. I'm not aggressive. And I would say that to our listeners. Don't be rude. Don't be confrontational. Don't give them an excuse. Just politely say, listen, I don't have to wear one. And carry
on. And I've got there is also another thing that you can do. Obviously, you can't wear a mask while you're eating. If it gets to the point where they start insisting that people wear masks in the street, I don't wear a mask. If they get to the point where they do that and the police start getting heavy, then I'm going to buy myself a baguette, a rather large baguette, because they take forever to eat, and just walk around with that. And if the police stop me, I'll say, I'm eating.
A big Subway sandwich. I can picture Dr. Vernon Coleman walking around with a big Subway sandwich in his hand. But you know, that could lead us down another rabbit hole, which we could spend hours talking about. The mental health impact this is having on people, because they don't know whether they're coming or going, and they're nervous. You know,
that's part of deliberate policy. That's not an accident. Nothing that's happened has been an accident. Everything has been meant to happen. The suicide rates, the government, I mentioned earlier, government mortality figures. I can't find current, or at least I couldn't the other day, I haven't looked for a couple of days. The government mortality figures for suicide, they appear to be hiding. What a surprise, because everywhere I look, I see that the mortality figures for suicide in other countries are rocketing. And incidentally, the Royal College of Psychiatrists said the other day that the incidence of alcoholism, the number of people drinking too much alcohol to a dangerous level, is now in the UK, or it might have been England and Wales, it is about 8.5 million. So that's sort of 12 to 15% of the population are either now alcoholic or heading towards being alcoholics, because the lockdowns, the upset, the chaos, the confusion, the bewilderment is all just too much. And it is not an accident. It's all deliberate. I've been tracking this back, and everything that's happened in the last 6 months is all part. I know this sounds like conspiracy. For me, the only conspiracy that's going on is this conspiracy to convince us all that COVID is going to kill us all, and therefore it's worth destroying society for it. I remind you one other thing. The number of people, the government has admitted that the number of people who've died as a result of the lockdown will, in the end, be far greater than the number of people who could conceivably be considered to have died of COVID. That's how bad lockdowns are. But the whole of this nonsense was created years ago when the Club of Rome, you can trace all this back, the United Nations conferences, the various world commissions,
Rockefeller Foundation,
Club of Rome. You go back 1990 something. They actually produced a book which said what we need is a global enemy, And what we have decided to pick is global warming. And global warming was selected. It had been around since Victorian times, but there was never any evidence that it was anything more than a bit of an anti-capitalist nonsense. Global warming was deliberately selected and then taken up by the United Nations. I know this sounds lunatic. You can check it all out, because I've been researching this for weeks and getting more and more astonished at what I find that fits in completely. Boris today said that what he's going to do is increase the amount of land in Britain to which nothing happens to 30%. That is a direct policy of the United Nations Agenda 21.
You know, on the global warming stuff, you and I will have a debate someday. As we said, I'll take the pro position. I've read those books and those documents, and they're startling, because you're right. Here you have a group of very influential people planning to use, you know, this issue to change and transform society and human behaviour. I just want to point out, and again, you can give me a kick in the arse off air for doing this, but I'll do it anyway. I just want to point out there are people who listen to this programme and they are very concerned about the environment. And they say, Richie, yes, OK, I do see that powerful groups want to use this issue and use it to, you know, bring about a very dystopian paradigm. But my environmental listeners, they do sometimes reach out to me and say, Richie, that doesn't mean that we're not, through our, you know, polluting of rivers and seas and through our creation of, you know, carbon, that we're not somehow impacting on the climate, well, and that I should be a bit more open to that, they tell me.
Absolutely, me too. I mean, I've been worried about the environment for probably decades longer than the Club of Rome and the United Nations. Of course we should be worried about the environment. We should be worried about the fact that there aren't any butterflies left. You can go through a summer and see hardly any butterflies. And there's a reason for that. There's hardly any bees. You can see a reason for
Vernon,
that.
Vernon, do me a favour. We've got 12 minutes left. It's just beginning to break up. It usually works when you hang up and call back. Do you mind doing that? Because it's breaking up. You've gone very 1970s football commentator there. So you've just gone. Vernon's going to hang up and call me back from secret location. God knows where. Dr. Vernon Coleman, he's going to stay with me till about 12-13 minutes past the hour. Stuart Waiton will join the programme then, PhD, Abertay University. Very bright guy, very interesting. Identity politics, criminologist. He'll be on as well. This show, you don't want to miss him. So, Vernon, thanks for doing that. You were explaining that, of course, you share the concerns of people who worry about the environment.
Yes, of course I do. What I object to is the way, and this has been done very cynically, is the way that people who are doing this with a vested interest keep telling us. And the BBC, let's face it, also has a "we don't discuss this, we don't debate this issue on climate change." What I object to is the way that people keep talking about, and I think it was Prince Charles who said the world would come to an end in 2017. But they all seem to have a date, and they all say the little Swedish girl has had several dates. They all seem to have a date when the world is going to end. The world is not going to end because of this. We have to take these things seriously, but we can't destroy our life in the meantime, because what's the point? The whole environment, global warming scenario was grabbed in 30 years ago because it was a very useful way to create an enemy to bring the world together, which also made human beings the enemy of themselves. So we became the enemy. We had to punish ourselves and allow the United Nations to do all these amazing things. People still think of the United Nations as just a fairly sort of it's insy-wincy organization which sends some guys in blue hats when there's a bit of fighting. But the United Nations has changed dramatically, and you have to remember the United Nations, one of its offshoots is the World Health Organization. These people are looking for ways to control us, and to be able to control us, they are using the climate change. I was actually writing about climate change as well decades ago. I mean, I prove this. I've got books that I've written with chapters on this. But the fact is that it has been taken up, hijacked, in order to push forward a scenario. It's part of an agenda, and the whole of this agenda, which is moving very quickly towards mandatory vaccines and all the rest of it, all the other nonsenses and having to have digital passports and things put under our skin. And don't say it's a joke to anybody, because it's
true.
Real. I've seen the evidence. And Bill Gates trying to block out the sun, it's not a joke, it's real. Bill Gates having genetically modified mosquitoes. All of this stuff has a single unified purpose. They're trying to change our world. They want to change it in very specific ways. I started to mention about Boris. Not only is he cutting, and by the way, some of his previous colleagues at The Spectator, when he was editor, think he seems to have gone potty, and I think they're right. I think Boris, everybody in the government must know what's behind all this. But Boris has actually given credence recently. He's bringing in the army to support the police. He wants a militia on our streets. He's allegedly giving MI5, this is according to the Daily Telegraph, I haven't seen anything other than the Daily Telegraph, but he's giving MI5 the license to kill people who are annoying the government. I mean, what sort of country is going on? I'd remind you again that an eminent German doctor who came to Britain to talk about the truth about COVID-19 was arrested, held in the cells in London. What is happening in this country? Why aren't people asking questions? All the chaos has things behind it. It's not accidental. It's a huge, huge conspiracy, and it's having a terrible effect on people.
You know,
A woman in the supermarket the other day looked at me through her visor with great sadness in her eyes and despair, which is so common now. Mental illness is rocketing. And she looked at me and she said, we've got to get the R number down.
Jesus.
We've got to get the R number down. The R number is of no consequence. What matters is the number of people needing to be hospitalized and the number of people dying. But they have fiddled these testing figures. It's probably not a mistake, but the thing that I've seen Hancock do is somebody said to him, look, the test is 1%, giving a 1 to 4%, say 2%, it's actually more than that, a 2% false positive. Now, what Hancock seemed to think was that that meant that 2% of the positives that you got were false.
Yeah, that's right.
It means 2% of all the people you've tested was false. And when you do that, you realize that there actually isn't any COVID left, because everybody's testing positive because they've got old bits of virus. If you had a cold or anything in the last 6-12 months, you'll test positive. So that enables the government to then do these terrible things to students, old people, closing down towns, and heaven knows what, closing down whole cities, putting them into lockdown. And you say, well, are the hospitals full of people? Are people who are dying? No, they're not. Nothing's happening.
No.
Apart from keep finding all these people who are testing positive. And they're testing positive because everybody tests positive. As Peter Ebdon so brilliantly said, you can test the papaya fruit.
That's right.
One of them.
I shouldn't laugh, but yeah. Yeah.
Test is useless. And it isn't fit for purpose. That was Peter was brilliant on the Ian Collins program. I thought that was wonderful. And we just need people to do that. This is going to get worse if people don't stand up and do things.
Yeah.
Take leaflets, put leaflets through letterboxes, ring up radio programs and say, look, can you explain to me, you say there aren't any dangers with vaccines. In that case, why has the American government paid out billions of dollars to people who've been damaged? And so on and so forth. You need to push people in the mainstream media, because either they know or they're hiding what they know, or they just don't know because they're too damn stupid. Or if they work at the BBC, then they're deliberately suppressing information, presumably because that's what they've been asked to do or told to do. And let's not forget, the BBC has financial links with, come on, all together now, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is the biggest pro-vaccine group in the world.
In the world.
Now, why the BBC, if they interview Bill, they let him, they all do the same, Guardian, they let Bill get away with being called a great health expert. He's not a health expert anymore, I'm a software expert.
Yeah.
He's just a bloke who made a lot of money out of flogging rotten, in my view, software. Notice the in my view there. And has made himself a world expert on health, and who is now the biggest contributor to the World Health Organization, which is where the silly mask nonsense came from, because I can give you yards of evidence showing that masks are really bad and that they actually damage your health.
It's on your website.
Ways.
It's on your website. It's on. All that information can be read and seen and viewed at vernoncoleman.com, as can the copy and paste text for the leaflets. And I know a lot of people, I know vast amounts of people have already gone to the website and have printed off a leaflet by copying and pasting the pre-prepared text that you've that you've put together. The line is just a little bit deteriorating again, so let's leave it there for now. When, I mean, a brand new tube.com for an old man in a chair, you're going to be uploading a couple of episodes a week, so people should go there. Let us know as soon as somebody from Talk Radio reaches out to you, please. He said he would. He said he would. He said it was the right. And let's give Ian Collins a bit of credit, by the way, because I've been around radio presenters and producers for most of my working life, and I'm very critical of them. Ian Collins was old school. He was very professional in listening to Peter Ebdon. He mightn't have agreed with Peter Ebdon, but he heard him out, and he left the listeners. He allowed the listeners to reach their own conclusions. So, as we say in the Irish language, ma an buachal, good boy, well done to Ian Collins. He was brilliant. Let us know, Vernon.
Can I just add a word? If I was being slightly sticking pins in Ian, it was only because
you weren't.
I too think he's a good broadcaster. What I do think is that somebody on higher up in Talk Radio will say you can't have him on, because I've been pretty well and very effectively banned. Because, well, why could it possibly be? Is it possibly because I say things that might be embarrassing, and that if I went on the BBC, for example, I might say things about side effects and vaccine inefficiency? For example, has the BBC ever mentioned that there is only one of the nasal flu vaccines only had about a 3% success rate, so the CDC in America took it down? Have the NHS website says there's no vaccine that can give you the flu? What about the nasal vaccine? It's only a weakened virus. Sorry, I'll shut up and go in the phone.
No, it's good. No, it's important. We'll pick this up again, obviously, next Monday. But before that, people can go to brandnewtube.com, look for an old man in a chair, look for Dr. Vernon Coleman there. You'll find the channel quickly. Subscribe to it and do check out vernoncoleman.com. And to find all the information, on the left-hand side of, when you enter the website, there is a menu, choose health. And when you click health, you'll get all of the information that Vernon has been sharing with us today. Thanks for coming back on today. We'll talk before next Monday anyway. Great pleasure, Vernon. Thanks so much for today again.
Thanks very much, Richie. Cheers.
And bye for now. The brilliant Dr. Vernon Coleman live on Monday's Richie Allen radio programme. And the information on vaccine injuries and payouts, it's all true. I'm not going to play devil's advocate and challenge any of that. It's all true. The Club of Rome stuff, Rockefeller Foundation think tank stuff, it's all true. Now, you might say, well, I could look at that information and reach a different conclusion. Well, go ahead, by all means. But the information itself is true. That's why he claims that this has been an agenda. Like I said earlier on, David Icke got plenty of mentions on Talk Radio today. He's been writing about this stuff since the early 1990s. And when talking about that stuff, those think tanks, those roundtable organisations, those plans, he was telling the truth in those books as well. It's all there for anybody who wants to look at it. Getting people to look at it seems to be difficult, or becoming increasingly more and more difficult, just to say, have a look. You know, I'm never dogmatic with people. I say, have a look. Have a wee look. Here's headlines. Let's do the headlines. Don't forget Stuart Waiton, PhD doctor. Stuart Waiton will be on the programme really soon. Headlines from FSN.
From Features Story News in Washington, I'm Nick Harper. US President Donald Trump continues to deny a New York Times investigation that says he only paid $750 in federal taxes for 2 years running around the start of his presidency. Judge has blocked a Trump administration attempt to ban people downloading TikTok in the US, and at least 16 people have been killed in an outbreak of violence in Nagorno-Karabakh, a territory disputed by Armenia and Azerbaijan.
Thank you so much then, Nick. By the way, let me send my thanks to my great friend Mark Bajerski, great friend of mine who did me a big favour this weekend. So thanks, Mark. He's a great guy. If you want to check out Mark, go to markbajerski.com. That's markbajerski.com. Check him out on YouTube as well. He's a lovely bloke. Thank you, my friend. Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Nothing like it in the world. There's nothing like it, I tells you. Coming up after Seal, Dr. Stuart Waiton, PhD, live from Dundee. Music from Seal on the Richie Allen Radio Show, 22 minutes past the hour. Monday it is, the 28th of September, 2020. From the super city of Salford. I miss watching Salford City play football. There won't be any football until sometime next spring. It is all a bit mad. Apparently the mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, he's been speaking to BBC this afternoon. He's not happy about the pub curfew. You know that the 10 p.m. pub closing time has come in across the country, but a number of mayors and city council leaders, including Andy Burnham, are claiming that the curfew could do more harm than it actually prevents. And there were scenes, apparently, in Liverpool over the weekend where once everybody was kicked out at 10 o'clock from certain pubs, they congregated nearby in large numbers with carry out. That's what we used to call takeaway beers in Ireland years ago, carry out. They got their carry out. They got their cans of Stella and Foster's and God knows what else, McEwan's. What's the cheapest piss you've ever drunk? Be honest. Me, Hoffman's. A brew native to Waterford City that came in a silver can. The pissiest piss you've ever put to your lips. Hoffman's. I don't even know if they still make it at the brewery in Waterford. But it was cheap old shite anyway. It was so watered down before it got to the pubs that the pubs couldn't water it down. If you know where I'm coming from with that. I've just had a text from Stuart Waiton. He'll be with me in a moment. The PhD from Abertay University. Really, really interesting guy. He's been writing, well, he's a criminologist and based, of course, at, as I mentioned, at that university, teaching there on hate crime, politics, antisocial behaviour. He's an author and he's also, for some time, he's been writing articles for the newspapers, local and national, spiked online, the Times newspaper, The Independent. Really interesting bloke. We met up with Stuart a couple of years ago when he was writing extensively about the creation of vulnerable groups. Which is very interesting, of course, and very timely, isn't it? And how this was going to be problematic to society going forward. You know, governments and authorities, local or national, declaring people to be vulnerable groups, and that we have to be changing the way we think and talk and speak and tiptoe around them. And they need protected status. Groups of people, cultural groups of people, racial groups, and groups of you know people in a minority in terms of sexual orientation or whatever. So very good stuff. We'll talk to him in a moment. It's also interesting that he's a senior lecturer at Abertay University in Dundee, because I believe, just like Manchester, where they have locked down 1,700 students, and I think the University of Manchester is in some legal soup, I think it's in legal soup, because I think the university gave the impression to its students over the weekend that they couldn't leave. that they had to stay put. And I heard a lawyer speaking to, was it LBC Radio? It might have been Sky News, actually, saying that it was false imprisonment. He said it could be argued, legally, that it was false imprisonment, would you believe? So, I don't know. Let me just open my text now. Yes, lovely. Cool. Marvellous. Yeah. This is what you call multitasking. No producer, no editor, no runner, no tea person. If you say tea lady, you're a sexist bastard these days. Nobody, just me, just the big baldy gammon. I'm getting more abuse for the photographs Paul Ripley took of me on Friday as well. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. I can take it. I know I'm no oil painting. I have no misgivings. I have no ideas about my looks. So you can keep the abuse coming. I love it. Dutch gold, says Seamus. Dutch gold. Now there's piss. If you ever wanted to taste piss that is packaged and marketed as consumable alcohol, Dutch gold. Holy God, yeah. Absolute garbage. Yeah, this is filling. This is proper filling. Yeah, right. I'll take another tune then, so I'll shut up for a minute. Here's All Saints. Stuart Waite, and even better, be on the other side of this, or there'll be murders. Rightio then. Stuart Waiton is having difficulties opening up the old computer there. We're going to do it the old-fashioned way in a moment, I think. I hope so, after all of that build-up and all of that jazz. So let's hope we get him on in a moment. I'm sure we will. Before that, though, very quick break back in a minute. Just to remind you that I'll be speaking, joined tomorrow by the Freds, Richard and Fred Fairbrass, of the legendary Right Said Fred. Can't wait for that. I'll also have one of the doctors who's written a new book called Corona False Alarm? Dr. Sukharit Bagdi will be on the programme tomorrow. I was sent the book by the publishers last week, and the book is in the news this weekend. I'll tell you more about that a bit later on if I have time. So, lovely. I'm hearing from Stuart now. Right, back in a moment, and we will have Stuart waiting, I believe, then. The joys of doing a live radio show, presenting it and producing it at the same time. Sure, aren't I marvellous? Aren't I marvellous? I'm marvellous.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Lovely. Welcome back to the program. This is me. It is only me. Listen, let's welcome to the show. I've done the preamble already. I've given you the resume. He's a terrific columnist. He's a PhD professor, criminology, Abertay University, written incredibly interesting and vital articles on identity politics, on hate speech and hate crimes and all the rest of it. Let's welcome back to the program my old friend Stuart Waiton. And you're just like every professor I ever had at university when it comes to technology. You're just a little bit eccentric, Stuart, aren't you?
I'm not the best.
You're not the Mae West, as they say in London. It's a pleasure to welcome you back. It's been too long. Thanks for coming back. How do you feel about the national tackling of coronavirus? It isn't a loaded question. I'm asking everybody. I obviously get alternative points of view on this programme. Are you worried by the response to it? You're happy with the measures? How do you feel about it before we talk about the big Zoom event tomorrow and free speech and all of that? How do you feel about things now?
Well, I've been worried from the start because, I mean, it's one of the things I teach on is this thing called the Culture of Fear, which is a brilliant book by Frank Furedi. And one of the arguments in it, which, I mean, he wrote this in 1997, the opening line to his first edition, which I still think was his best, is something, it's along the lines of the one moral absolute, which he says with tongue in cheek, because it's not really moral, is safety. And essentially goes on to try and explain why we are creating a world that is built around safety and little else. And part of this sort of thesis of this is that almost everything becomes, almost every problem becomes exaggerated in society. And this can be seen with various things, but diseases is one of them in terms of the reaction. And people like Neil Ferguson have a record along these lines where they've made predictions of past sort of flus and expectations of millions of deaths and so on, where they always seem to get things completely wrong. And society has this thing called a precautionary principle. So the sort of people that run society are in many respects like a kind of small-minded health and safety executive who see nothing but risks and danger and see no solution other than to regulate more and more areas of life and society. And I think, I mean, that was the first article I wrote about this, just as this whole thing was kicking off, was saying, well, from a sociological perspective, looking at things through this prism, I suspect we will exaggerate the problem, become more regulatory and even authoritarian, not out of a desire to do this, but because we lack the political, moral, and even philosophical resources to be able to address society in the round and have a much more measured and mature approach to things. And that's how I think things are panning out. I think we have a disease that affects a relatively small proportion of the population, where originally we had an understanding that, you know, we needed some level of herd immunity, and it certainly wasn't about protecting everyone from it. And we've seemed to have shifted from that idea of not overwhelming the health service to almost trying to stop anybody at all from getting it. And the measures, as we can see, in all sorts of areas of life have become more and more problematic, I think, and more distant from people's experience. I think I'm extremely concerned, and I'm not sure how we can get out of it. That's what I'm worried about. I'm not sure how we can get out of this mindset where we feel that we have to protect everybody from a disease that, for the majority of people, you don't even know you've got it.
Yeah, it brushes the young, I've heard it said. I'm not going to get into, because I have too much respect for you, and we could do it another day anyway, that I know you believe that it's not out of a desire to make things more totalitarian. And I know you believe that, and you make a very compelling argument. I see it from the other point of view only because of, as days go by, you hear things like, everybody carrying a health passport on your smart device of choice. And that might determine in the near future whether you get access to, you know, I know you're a football fan. I know you love footy just as I do. You might not get to go and watch your football team. You might not get to go and watch a concert. And, you know, pushing people towards taking medicines that they mightn't want to take, whether they don't want to do that for reasonable reasons, or, you know, whether otherwise, you know, I would have always said people should have body autonomy. And when I see things going that way, and I hear people talking about a future, and I've heard this said by this woman, Dr. Margaret, what's her face, World Health Organization woman, used by Sky pretty much every day, Margaret Harris. They want testing to be the norm, way beyond COVID, for everybody, where you do a test. And that's what makes me think that somewhere along the line, somebody was waiting for a nasty virus or something along those lines, you know, to push us down those particular roads. That's all I'm going to say on that. I mean, did you ever imagine carrying health passports on your phone and having a device read it at the turnstiles of the football stadium? And I can't believe we're here, Stuart, to be honest.
Well, the way I would think about it is, I don't think that health woman and people like her have got a kind of authoritarian zeal like past authoritarians. Although, but I do think they have a disrespect for the public, which, and that's where I think you have a problem, where you have a society of a kind of new elites of various types who are more disconnected from the public and see the public in a kind of a more negative and distrusting way. And I think that kind of fuels their desire to a certain extent to have more regulations, because they are distrusting, perhaps more than elites might have been in the past. So, yes, I think there are lots of problems with this, and I think we should be concerned about it. And I think we need desperately to try and find a way out of this, because of all the, I mean, I'm sure you've looked at all the problems that this is raising, and it's raising all sorts of problems.
Well, the government themselves, you're right, and the government itself has said the lockdown might kill very many more people than any respiratory infection has done. That's important to note as well. I've got to ask you, because you're on, what's the situation at your university? We've heard mention of your university on BBC Radio over the last couple of days. In Manchester, they've locked down a couple of thousand students. That's really problematic, because apparently they gave those students the impression here, and I'm not making this up, they gave them the impression that they had no choice, that it was basically criminal not to stay on campus over the weekend. And I know there's legal, there's a legal issue there. But what's going on up there, Stuart? Are students being told to isolate in the numbers that we've heard on the radio?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's relatively small in terms of the campuses themselves, and more generally, just like I think most students in Scotland are now being told that they can't go to pubs, for example, and shouldn't really be going out, which it becomes that, where that becomes particularly problematic, I think, is people like mature students or many students who only come into university to go to their lectures, but aren't part of a student body as such, which I think a lot of our students are like that. So it's people who are just living, if you like, they're not living student lives, if you know what I mean. They're not kind of part of the general student milieu. Not to say that you would necessarily support the limits on them, but for those individuals, it's particularly unusual that, at least as far as the contact with the universities been, that they're not meant to go to pubs and other places either. So that's where we are.
And again, you mentioned earlier, these are groups of people for whom the virus isn't dangerous remotely. And again, I've got to say this, some very credible men and women with the same letters after their names as some of the regular talking heads. So I'm talking about Carl Hennigan and Sunetra Gupta. They're not getting a fair go on commercial and national media. They're slowly but surely starting to appear, but they're not getting much time, because Hennigan is of the belief, and he's eminent in his field, that you've got to allow the virus run through that group of people, because that's how you build up herd immunity. And that's just not being heard. Stuart Waiton is our guest. A successful author, criminologist, sociologist. As I said, he's written, of course, for national, and does write for national newspapers in this country. Very interesting articles on subjects that we need to be talking more about. The creation of vulnerable groups, hate speech. I got to ask you, I know Lawrence Fox, the actor who, of course, has been making national headlines for months now since his appearance on Question Time. I have to say I like him. I like the way he speaks. I have a lot of sympathy with what he stands for. He has launched a new political party. We know this. And he's involved in a big Zoom event tomorrow night that everybody can get on, talking about freedom of speech and cancel culture. Tell us a little bit about that, because, again, when I first met you, you were warning people about cancel culture and the implications of it for people going forward. You were one of the first people, I think, to really see that and to begin to write about it. So tell us about this tomorrow night, Stuart, Lawrence Fox, and what's going on.
Yeah, it's called a Scottish Salon. So if people want to go on Facebook and look up Scottish Salon, I think that's the best way of finding it. I'm not sure how big Zoom is in terms of whether it can take millions or whether there's a cutoff. My friend who's organising it said there's a cutoff, but I think he might have just been saying that to try and force people to sign up.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know how Zoom works, but as far as I know, you can come on to it. Essentially, it's a discussion about the hate crime legislation that's developing in Scotland, which Lawrence Fox has said he wants to speak on. So, you know, we're happy to have him. Interested to see what he has to say. We've also got Jim Sillars, who's an ex-SNP leader, who's highly critical of the hate crime legislation. And Carlton Brick, who's a lecturer at the West of Scotland University. So that's the framework. It's a critical look at the new hate crime legislation in Scotland, which, I mean, the funny thing is, I keep saying this, but it keeps being true. Each piece of legislation developed in Scotland becomes the most authoritarian piece of legislation I've ever seen. And I've kept saying that, and it seems to be being true.
Gets worse.
And this piece of legislation is astonishing in terms of if it passes in the form it is, which I'm hoping it won't, it's remarkable.
Hey, just before you tell us why you're that worried about it, if folks want to get on this tomorrow night, it won't cost you anything. Go to eventbrite.co.uk and look for Scotland Salon, S-A-L-O-N, the hate crime bill. Stuart sent me a link, so I'll put the link on Twitter later on and on Facebook. I will remember to do that. If you want to hear, because he's right, I've been looking into it myself, not with Stuart's academic eye, of course, but I've had a look at it. This hate crime bill they want to bring in Scotland, tell us why it's so terrifying. What will it do?
Yeah, well, you don't need an academic eye. I'm sure you and anyone else can look at this stuff and make their own minds up extremely well, as that's what a democracy is all about. Well, this hate crime bill, what it does is it takes the idea of stirring up hatred, which at the minute is only in relation to on the issue of race and only in very specific circumstances, but it now takes the idea of stirring up hatred and stretches it to every other so-called protected characteristic, including older people. So they're now introducing older people in Scotland as a protected characteristic. This can include the idea of being abusive. So in theory, if you are abusive to a transgender person, an elderly person, a gay person, disabled person, so on and so forth, you could be committing a hate crime, a hate speech crime, essentially, which is what it is. And this stretches, so that's bad enough, because this could mean, you know, what does abusive mean? Who determines that? Well, this is determined by the idea of reasonableness, which will be determined by a judge. So again, who's to say what reasonableness means? Extremely subjective, flexible, politically flexible as well, in terms of, you know, once something is in the limelight, like the transgender issue, for example.
Yeah.
You've seen the furore with J.K. Rowling, etc. Is she being abusive? Is that reasonable? Who's to judge? So all these groups, and it there is no protection of the private realm. So this is things you may say in your own home, or books you may have in your own home, which could be seen as being abusive and stirring up hate. It incorporates plays and comedy. For the first time ever, also now actors, because in other legislation in relation to race, they just say directors and the producers, so the people who are putting it on. Now could it also incorporate actors, so just being an actor and saying something, which is seen as abusive, that could stir up hate, could be a hate crime. And it targets organisations, so organisations would be culpable if hate is being expressed, so that could mean a newspaper, or it could mean a university. So it is the most astronomical attack on freedom of thought and speech that one could imagine.
I heard Stella Creasy talking on talk radio last week about misogyny, which obviously ties into this. And she told a story that I didn't believe. But then again, that's my own unconscious bias, maybe, because I don't really like Stella Creasy. But she said, oh, I can't tell you how many times I've had to run down the road while some guy ran after me trying to grab my breast. I just can't imagine that. We're living in 2020. I can imagine it happening to somebody, but I can't imagine this being a regular thing that women are enduring on their days out or their evenings out. But anyway, let's just say she's right. So I'll be devil's advocate just for a minute. If women are being harassed like that, and if blokes are saying sexually suggestive things to women, whether it's from building sites, scaffolds, or from whatever, doesn't she have a point that this is motivated by some, you know, inherent revulsion of women or condescending opinion of women, and that maybe it needs to be looked at, maybe?
Well, women aren't incorporated yet, so that's another aspect of this. They haven't included gender yet.
That's it.
But they have set up a commission to look at the gender question. So that's possibly the next thing coming. And that's fine. I mean, you know, I'm a lefty. My campaigns were about women's rights, gay rights, against racism, and so on. And I think you should challenge discrimination. And the way you challenge discrimination is you argue with people. You make sure that people aren't discriminating against people in the workplace. You're not discriminating in housing and so on. That's entirely legitimate. What it does, I mean, your example of the wolf whistling and so on, what seems to be happening is they see this as a progressive thing, but what it actually does is it redefines people as victims and vulnerable.
Yeah.
It redefines entire bodies of people as being unable to cope with minor unpleasantries, with people being a bit sexist or a bit offensive. And it turns essentially almost every possible interaction becomes a possible crime because of the subjective nature of it. It's the how people experience that. Because some people might not mind that someone wolf whistles, right? Some people might find it really offensive. But historically, that's not been seen as a harm, you know, in a classical liberal sense. Harm has been understood as something much more serious than that, than just feeling a bit uncomfortable or offended. But even this term of uncomfortable starts to be used in court now. In my case, I was looking at this Adnan Ahmed in Scotland, pickup artist who's just been released from prison. You read this transcript of the crime and terms like uncomfortable are used, and you think, well, what does that mean in terms of law and crime? Someone makes you feel uncomfortable, and who makes you feel uncomfortable? You know, if you like the look of the person, do you not feel uncomfortable? But if you don't like the look of the person, does that make you feel uncomfortable? Does one then become a crime and the other one not become a crime? It's so subjective and so predicated on almost of encouraging people to feel offended and to feel vulnerable in relation to other people. And that's what I find probably the most problematic thing in all of this, is it seems to almost create barriers between people, you know, where we feel so potentially vulnerable to an advance by someone from the opposite sex or whoever, that we call in the law, that we say we need our personal space protected to the nth degree. And then what doesn't become criminalized? You know, what sort of behavior could not be seen as potentially making people feel uncomfortable or having a sense of fear and alarm and so on? So we move from what would be a clear form of harassment that I think most people would see as being, you know, that's unreasonable, that sort of behavior, to all sorts of behavior which seem to be more to do with the kind of political preoccupations of a certain section of society that they want to enforce upon the rest of us, rather than allowing, you know, as much as possible people to have, you know, get on with each other, get on with it, deal with one another, deal with life, you know, have a strength of capacity, strength, character. These are the things I think we should be encouraging, rather than sort of laws that, you know, almost disempower massive sections of the population.
I think a lot of people are, I hear from a lot of people who are waking up to it. I think we've only got a few minutes left. I might go over by a couple of minutes, but I want to keep you on just for a couple of two things I want to say. One, thanks for what you said about, you know, confronting ideas that you might find unsavory by debating people, not by trying to ban them. As somebody who's been in radio for many, many years, I've seen a terrible shift away from that as an idea into banning people. I've seen it on my own programme, you know, various people telling me that they were very offended by people whom I've interviewed. And I nothing prepared me for that. It's a strange thing. There's it was brought to my attention today, and I didn't know this because I don't pay any attention to what people say about me or most other people. But there's an entrance on the Wikipedia page about this programme, which is critical of some of the guests, including a guest from a radio programme in Sweden. And even though the presenter, me, Muggins here, disagreed with the person on her views on racial identity, her views on white genocide, and her belief in a Jewish conspiracy, it's still bad enough to have her on. And it's not, and it's so dangerous that it really is. And I don't know what you know. I don't have any personal concerns about that, but it's a terrible thing. We were brought up to argue with people who you saw the world. You know, they saw the world through a different lens. So you would argue with them. And thanks for constantly banging that drum about challenging people, not by banning them, but challenging them. Let me ask you before we go, and I have already tweeted a link out to Eventbrite Scotland Salon. Stuart Waiton is our guest. Last question, Stuart. Are you and your colleagues being asked, as they seem to be in some London-based universities, to submit yourself to unconscious bias training?
Yes.
Mother of Jesus. And what's your response to that? Do you mind me asking?
My response, I just do it because I have to.
You have to.
But I think it's extremely problematic, to say the least. I find the whole idea of unconscious bias is, it's scientifically illegitimate as far as I can see. I think it's quite patronizing as well. And I think most staff just do these things out of a matter of course, because it's something that they're required to do. I find the whole thing worrying that it seems to be acceptable to somehow have your employer determining what your unconscious is, to say the least. I mean, just to say a bit on your thing about Wikipedia. Funny thing is, I've got a Wikipedia page which somebody else set up on my behalf to try and put me down. And they do things like this, like innuendo, he's a bit of this, he's a bit of that, and he was on the Richie Allen show.
Yeah.
Yeah. that right-wing show, the Richie Allen Show.
Presented by a Bolivarian devotee, a man who worships Salvador Allende and Hugo. Yeah. Oh, Jesus. Don't get me started. Yeah, it's crazy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so I find that really, really unpleasant because that sort of activity is purposeful misrepresentation.
Yeah.
I mean, purposeful misrepresentation to attempt to sully your name. And they know exactly what they're doing. There's nothing, you know, the people often say things like, they do this for a good cause, you know, do this for a good reason and so on. I mean, when people do things like that, it's just despicable.
Well, it can have real world consequences for people. I mean, I've got two of your books here. I have. I've read you extensively. I'm not here now to be your agent or to be an apologist for you. I don't have to be. Your work is exceptional. It stands up on its own. You obviously don't have a bigoted bone in your body. You're somebody who likes, as I do, to speak about things that, while they might be uncomfortable for somebody, they're very important things to be speaking about and talking about right now. But this is a tactic, yeah? It's a strange thing. My friends back home, because I've not been home for years, they say they find it hilarious that I would be considered to be, you know, some sort of right-wing guy, a trade unionist my entire life, you know, like yourself, Stuart. I mean, you're a Northeast man. You come from mining stock. You're born and bred lefty. But it's not funny because that could have consequences for your career if your employers didn't know better.
Yeah, absolutely. That's utterly despicable. And that's a dimension, again, one of the most troubling dimensions of modern life and to some extent modern student activist life, is that they call for people to be sacked. Yeah. And this is something that is really new, you know? I mean, people were never that degenerate until recently.
Yeah.
Calling for people to have their livelihoods and their lives destroyed because you disagree with their opinions is utterly degenerate. And that's why I'm so determined to stick in at this and have a fight, because, you know, I know I'm on the side of right, and these people seriously need to be defeated with ideas, better ideas.
They do, because they don't. I think, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. You know, there's a little bit of that. I tried to engage with them, not in a patronising way. That might have sounded very patronising. But I tried to say to them, look, let me try to give you a glimpse of what the world will be like if, you know, if your argument is seen through, if you win the day. It's going to be horrendous. You can't live like that. We can't live like that. And to be fair, I see more and more people coming back and saying, you're right, Richie, you know. I see more black men and women. And I'm delighted to see more black men and women taking to social media saying, I'm nobody's victim and I don't need to be protected from the opinions of some idiot. I can deal with it myself, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. None of this necessarily comes, you know, it's not that ordinary black people have created a world obsessed about race. You know, this is from, you know, just middle-class academics more than anything else, and other kind of professional activists. It's not from ordinary people. And I agree. I think there's a backlash. I think the Trump vote was a backlash. I don't mean that in an entirely negative way, but I think there's all sorts of reactions taking place. And the outrage, I think, to statues being pulled down here and there and everywhere. I think this, you know, this term, the silent majority, I think it's really true. I expect Trump to win the next election because of this as well. Could be wrong, but that's my expectation.
Thanks for coming back on the show. You're welcome anytime. Tomorrow night, folks, I've put the link to it on Twitter, eventbrite.co.uk, Scotland Salon, debating the proposed hate crime bill in Scotland, which, as Stuart has brilliantly explained, is terrifying. It really is. Check it out and share it with others. Thanks for coming back, mate. Like I said, anytime you want an atter, give us a shout.
Cheers.
And come back.
Cheers.
Thanks, Stuart. Stuart Waiton, live on the line there from Dundee. He's a professor. Professor? What the hell is that? He's a professor of sociology, criminology, very, very highly thought of, a newspaper columnist and a public speaker, author as well, very important. And the reason I dropped that in a minute ago, one of the things I don't do at all is talk about myself. This is the world they want. It staggers me. I still chuckle when somebody sends me a link to something that was changed on the Wikipedia page for the Richie Allen Show. It makes me chuckle, you know, that they're not saying nasty things about the show because I've said things. Rather, that I've had certain people on. And that's the most dangerous idea that I've ever had to deal with. The idea that you wouldn't have people on because what those people are saying is offensive to a third party. Imagine, Lana Loctef was on this program, Red Ice Radio. We had a good back and forth, good bit of banter. I disagreed with her about the Jewish conspiracy. We had a good chat. She got her ideas out. I argued with her. But although disagreeing with her on white genocide, on a Jewish conspiracy, Alan praised her for her intelligence. I praised her for being a good guest who was a good sport, who could have an argument with me. And following that, the Board of Deputies of British Jews said that people should stay away from the show. But I fucking argued with her. I disagreed with her. I like to think I poked a few holes in her argument. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Right. No, the new paradigm, or the one being created, is you're supposed to never, ever, ever speak to people like her. Because by doing so, you might as well announce that you see the world exactly the same as they do. It's madness. And it's dangerous. And it's not dangerous so much for me, but it is dangerous for people like Stuart Waiton, a lefty, a trade unionist, who doesn't have a racist bone in his body. But I know that his university has been contacted by people complaining that he deigned to appear on this radio show. These people are fucking nuts. And they have to be dealt with peacefully. Never resort to violence or intimidation. Defeat them peacefully. Destroy them in debate. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why they won't come on programmes like this. Because I'm too experienced a radio presenter. I would take them apart at the knees on air, these people, which is why they don't come on. And I'm not bigging myself up. There are a lot of people making independent content that would also eviscerate these people. Stuart Waiton would take these people apart. That's why they prefer to scream abuse at people on Twitter and demand that they are deplatformed and fired rather than take them on head to head in a debate. This is mad stuff, folks. This is mad stuff. Right, so we've gone over the time then. I've got to take 6 minutes off the programme tomorrow. Thank you to Dr. Vernon Coleman. Go to vernoncoleman.com. Vernon has very helpfully linked to the government website section on mask exemptions. So if you go to vernoncoleman.com, you'll find all you need to know about mask exemptions. Thank you, Vernon. And thank you to Stuart Waiton, PhD. I've been to BBG. Until tomorrow, see you then, and...